The headlines: China holds the second day of its largest ever military drills around Taiwan amid rising tensions in the region. Israel has closed its crossing with the Gaza Strip, further tightening its blockade on the territory that has been in place since 2007. And the United States declares a monkeypox outbreak a public health emergency amid a shortage of vaccines and treatments for the disease across the country.
Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
China begins the second day of its largest ever military drills around Taiwan amid rising tensions over the self-ruled island. The Chinese military says the exercises involve conventional missile firepower assault in waters off the east of Taiwan. Taipei says Chinese fighter jets and ships cross the median line that runs down the Taiwan Strait. It described the move as highly provocative. The drills kicked off a day after U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi concluded its trip to Taiwan. China says the war games worked as a countermeasure in the face of the provocations by the U.S. and its allies in Taiwan. Washington, however, calls the drills a gross overreaction to Pelosi's visit. On Friday, Pelosi, in a press conference, said Washington will not allow China to isolate Taiwan.
They may try to keep Taiwan from visiting or participating in other places, but they will not isolate Taiwan by preventing us to travel there. We've had high-level visits, senators in the spring, a bipartisan way, continuing visits, and we will not allow them to isolate Taiwan.
Pelosi said Washington continues its support for Taiwan. The House Speaker, however, said her trip was not aimed at changing the status quo in Taiwan. She made the comments in Japan, which is the final destination of her East Asia tour. China has rebuked the U.S. for Pelosi's travel to the island. It says Washington is playing with fire and has vowed to punish those who offended Beijing. China sees Taiwan as part of its territory.
Tensions are ratcheting up between the United States and China over U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Pelosi arrived in Taiwan late on Tuesday despite harsh warnings from China. Pelosi is known for her anti-China stance and is the highest elected U.S. official to visit the island since 1997. China is now furious over the visit and has warned of a harsh response.
Well, first of all, both countries, the United States and China, cannot afford to have a hot war now because November is coming up. In the United States, it's the midterm elections. Both Nancy Pelosi and Biden risk seeing their support slipping away. As for China, November is also coming up, signaling the National People's Congress, which is supposed to confirm the presidency's third term, as well as unveiling a new leadership lineup of the top six or seven leaders of the Standing Committee of the Politburo.
China has now threatened to carry out, quote, targeted military operations in response to the visit. The situation around Chinese Taipei is already tense. China has deployed military hardware there and is conducting massive large-scale drills. The exercises feature J-20 stealth fighter jets and test firing of conventional missiles. Chinese military officials say the military exercises are a, quote, a stern deterrence against the United States over Taiwan and a serious warning for supporters of Taiwan independence. This is while some believe the goal of these exercises is to prepare for the military fight with Taiwan. But some believe the visit has in fact put China in the difficult position of having to show a resolute response while avoiding a full-blown conflict.
China's military exercises have been planned in advance. So there is a live fire military exercises now going on quite near Taiwan, less than 100 miles, and then six zones, military exercise zones have been identified surrounding the Taiwan Island, and with live fire military exercises in all the six regions, in effect blockading the Taiwan Island for 3 days, just to show, just to teach Taiwan a lesson and to clear, send a clear signal that China's red line has truly been crossed.
The U.S. House Speaker's visit to a Chinese Taipei has been met with opposition and has also been censured both inside and outside Chinese Taipei. Iran's foreign minister has said the trip was a turning point in ties between the United States and China. Russia has backed China and said its visit set China and the U.S. on a collision course.
Pelosi's visit to Taiwan has been condemned by China's allies, including Iran and Russia. Moscow says Russia backs China over the Taiwan issue, warning that the provocative trip would put the United States on a collision course with Beijing. Iran says the visit to Taiwan is a turning point in the already tense ties between China and the U.S. and will have reverberations across the world. Iran has also expressed full support for the One China policy. The crisis dates back to the time when the People's Republic of China was created in 1949. After the Communist Party seized power in mainland China in 1949, the U.S. refused to recognize it as a rightful government in China. Back then, the U.S. decided to open its embassy in Taipei. In the 1970s, Washington and Beijing decided to normalize their ties. In 1979, the U.S. formally recognized the communist-run People's Republic of China and cut ties with Taipei. This meant that the United States recognized the People's Republic of China as the only legal government of China. But following that, the U.S. Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which has underpinned the U.S. policy towards Taiwan ever since. The act authorizes de facto diplomatic relations and allows the U.S. government to provide weapons to Taiwan.
The unification of Taiwan is very high up on Beijing's agenda. In fact, President Xi Jinping has made it quite plain that the latest time frame for Taiwan unification is the 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. But the ideal solution is still peaceful unification. But peaceful unification comes up with the reality that most of the Taiwanese people do not want a unification. But neither do they want independence, because independence would affect their livelihood or threaten their security. All they want is to maintain the status quo forever. But again, this risks that Taiwan will be drifting further and further away from China. So I think that China is likely to adopt a policy in the same way as they China succeeded in having Hong Kong being united with the motherland.
The U.S. is now the largest arms provider to Taiwan. The Taiwan crisis comes amid shifting geopolitical alliance. The Ukraine crisis has already weakened the hegemonic position of the United States and its allies. It now appears that Washington is trying to provoke another crisis in the East Asia region to reassert its hegemony.
Israel has closed its crossing with Gaza, further tightening its inhumane blockade of the territory that has been in place since 2007. According to analysts, the ongoing closure of the crossings will further decrease the already low standards of living in this tiny seaside territory. Ashraf Shannon reports.
The Israeli regime has sealed its crossings with the Gaza Strip since Tuesday, further exacerbating the humanitarian situation in the impoverished territory. Currently, there are two Israeli-controlled crossings into the tiny coastal territory: the Kerem Shalom commercial crossing, located on the southernmost tip of the Gaza Strip, and the Erez pedestrian crossing in northern Gaza. The crossings have been partially operating since Israel imposed a tight blockade on Gaza in 2007.
The Israel closure of the crossings for the third day has serious, severe implications on the lives of the Palestinians in Gaza Strip. we are calling on the international community for immediate actions to pressure Israel to lift the blockade in Gaza.
The impoverished coastal territory already suffers from high poverty and unemployment rates. Most Gazans also depend on handouts from international aid agencies to survive.
Closing the crossing point from the Israeli occupation, it's a collective punishment. It's part of blackmail against Palestinian people. Over 2 million people living in Gaza, they are living in the huge jail. The social and economic situation so deteriorated.
For 15 years, the Israeli regime has kept an illegal and inhumane closure on the Gaza Strip, affecting the lives of more than 2 million Palestinians and restricting their freedom of movement.
Gaza crisis, due to the Israeli continuous blockade for 15 years, suffering from serious implications on the economy, on the humanitarian conditions, the employment, food insecurity, poverty increased to unprecedented percentages.
Tel Aviv's move to shut down the crossings will further complicate living conditions in the impoverished territory. According to human rights groups, the Israeli blockade has wreaked havoc on the economy of Gaza and worsened its humanitarian conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran says the United States can use the Vienna talks as an opportunity to prove its seriousness in returning to the 2015 deal. Iran's Director General for International Peace and Security, Asadollah Ashrafi Jahromi, made the remark at the 10th NPT review conference. He said the current U.S. administration has criticized the maximum pressure campaign of former President Donald Trump against Iran, but ended up adding more sanctions to that list. Ashrafi also slammed the European parties to the JCPOA. He said they failed to honor their obligations and even supported Washington's sanctions policy. The senior Iranian diplomat said the country has the right to enjoy the peaceful use of nuclear energy. Iran's deputy foreign minister and top negotiator has held talks in Vienna as part of negotiations to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Ali Bagharikani held talks with European Union's coordinator Enrique Mora. Prior to that, he met with the Russian envoy Mikhail Yolanov. The top Iranian negotiator is leading a delegation who arrived in the Austrian capital earlier on Thursday to resume talks to restore the pact. The JCPOA was derailed after Washington withdrew from it in 2018. The remaining parties have held several rounds of talks since April last year, but the negotiations came to a halt in March due to what Iran calls the U.S. failure to show goodwill as well as its excessive demands. Muslims around the world are marking the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein III, Shia Imam. In Iran, mass mourning processions have been held to commemorate Imam Hussein's sacrifice for Islam. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Black-clad mourners beating on their chests and listening to elegies in honor of a man who lived 14 centuries ago but continues to touch the hearts of Muslims. Mass processions are underway in Iran to mark the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia imam, Imam Hussein. Iranians from all walks of life have been participating in the ceremonies to pay respect to their imam.
The love of Ashura's philosophy should be gathered and extended around the world. I believe that because it's not just the love for Muslims or specifically Shias, I believe it's a love that everyone can learn and everyone can understand, because it's not just a matter of your religion, it's a matter of a man that sacrificed everything in his path for his beliefs.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Imam Hussein was a true freedom seeker who stood against the unjust and corrupt ruler of his time, Yazid. We as Muslims remember him every year to safeguard what our Imam stood for.
Imam Hussein was the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. Based on Islamic references, the Shia Imam and 72 of his companions were killed in the lunar month of Muharram in 680 AD in modern-day Iraqi city of Karbala by the forces of the second Umayyad Caliph Yazid. The asymmetrical battle was triggered after Imam Hussein refused to pay allegiance to Yazid, for he believed that the Caliph did not exercise true Islam as taught by the Prophet.
People believe Imam Hussein's sacrifices saved Islam from distortion and manipulation by Yazid. And this is just one reason why his love hasn't died down in the hearts of Muslims after 14 centuries.
Shia Muslims never miss out on the 10-day mourning ceremonies for Imam Hussein. They say these rituals are meant to keep Imam Hussein's flag aloft and preserve his legacy for the generations to come. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The United States has declared monkeypox outbreak a public health emergency. The move will speed up the delivery of vaccines to curb the spread of the disease. The U.S. has reported over 6,600 monkeypox cases so far. A quarter of these cases have appeared in New York. The declaration comes amid reports that vaccines and treatments for monkeypox are in short supply across the U.S. Last month, the World Health Organization declared the outbreak a global health emergency. Monkeypox primarily spreads through close physical contact and generally causes a mild disease. However, it can be fatal and cause serious symptoms. A former Twitter employee is being tried in the U.S. for handing over personal information on Saudi dissidents to the kingdom. Ahmed Abu Mamu allegedly traded user data for $100,000 and an expensive watch. It was revealed that the defendant was in close contact with a top advisor of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He was arrested in 2019 on a number of charges, including being an illegal agent of a foreign government. Prosecutors accused him of being enlisted by Saudi officials between 2014 and 2015 to get private information on accounts of firing off posts critical to the regime. The ex-Twitter employee faces 20 years in prison if convicted of these charges.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby.
Hussein, 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 I cry for you in pain. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you.
in the limelight.
In his 2017 decision, U.S. District Judge Hittner found that ExxonMobil committed, over a period of 5 years, 16,386 days of violation under the Clean Air Act, emitting 8 million pounds of hazardous pollutants, more than what's allowed by state and federal laws, and clean air permits. We now present you an article written by Josephine Lee under the heading, ExxonMobil is counting on Trump-chosen judge to undermine right to sue polluters. A new ruling on Environment Texas versus ExxonMobil is expected this August. In its second appeal, ExxonMobil is asking the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to restrict the rights citizens have to sue polluters in U.S. federal court. One presiding judge, Trump-appointed Federalist Society member Andrew Oldham, agrees. The largest American oil company has already lost the 12-year-old Clean Air Act citizen lawsuit twice. In 2010, Environment Texas and Sierra Club sued ExxonMobil on behalf of residents of Baytown, Texas, who suffered respiratory and other illnesses as a result of toxic emissions from the company's Baytown plant, its largest in the world. In 2017, U.S. District Judge David Hittner ordered the company to pay a $20 million penalty to the U.S. Treasury, the biggest citizens' lawsuit penalty to date. After the Fifth Circuit overturned that ruling on Exxon's first appeal, District Judge David Hittner knocked the penalty down to $14.25 million. Now, ExxonMobil is claiming that Baytown residents have no legal standing to bring the lawsuit to federal court, even though the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, maintains its ability to regulate pollutant emissions after the Supreme Court hamstrung the agency's ability to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, and state environmental agencies, like the one in Texas, have faltered in enforcing the Clean Air Act. Citizen lawsuits have long been used to hold polluters accountable when federal and state agencies fail to act. If the Fifth Circuit agrees with ExxonMobil's argument, this would deal a devastating blow to any environmental group or community that seeks to bring a citizen lawsuit to federal court. Sharon Sprayberry is one of the key witnesses for the plaintiffs in Environment Texas versus ExxonMobil. Sharon Sprayberry had first tried reporting to the EPA the incidence of chemical emission flares she witnessed coming from ExxonMobil's Baytown plant, located less than 2 miles away from her home. Sprayberry said, "The first time I heard it, I thought it was a tornado. It was like a freight train roar," adding, "I looked at the sky and it just lit up bright orange. It started at 1 or 2 in the afternoon and it went all night and it never ever got dark. After several failed attempts to get the Environmental Protection Agency to act, Sprayberry says, the EPA then passed her on to the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, which then twirled me around and did nothing. Using data from the Environmental Protection Agency's own annual enforcement reports, the Environmental Integrity Project found that the yearly average number of inspections, investigations, and prosecutions have declined by half over the past 20 years, a decline that started before the Trump administration. The report cites the Environmental Protection Agency's deference to states to enforce environmental laws as a primary reason for this decline. The Texas Commission of Environmental Quality, tasked to enforce federal and state environmental laws, is headed by three commissioners appointed by the governor. This year, The Texas Commission of Environmental Quality is up for review by the Sunset Advisory Commission, a group of 10 state legislatures and two laypeople who review the performance of the state's agencies every 12 years. During a hearing, the Sunset Advisory Commission called the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality reluctant regulators. The Sunset Advisory Commission's report notes that the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality relies on the industry to self-report and self-monitor illegal emissions. The agency has no compliance history data for 400,000 facilities, 89% of facilities across the state. Even when facilities do report their emissions, the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality does not pursue any action when plants explain the illegal emissions were unplanned, unavoidable, and properly reported, a legal concept called affirmative defense. According to the report, over the last 5 years, the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality has granted affirmative defenses for an average of 87% of unauthorized emission events reported annually. Another Environmental Integrity Project reported revealed that the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality only penalized 3% of air pollution violations from 2011 to 2016. Even when penalties are issued by the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality, they're usually small and oftentimes less than the cost of maintaining or upgrading equipment to comply with the emissions standards. In his 2017 decision, District Court Judge David Hittner found that ExxonMobil committed, over a period of 5 years, 16,386 days of violation under the Clean Air Act, emitting 8 million pounds of hazardous pollutants, more than what's allowed by state and federal laws and clean air permits. Before the lawsuit, the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality had failed to issue any corrective action or penalties against the company's Baytown complex. After the lawsuit was filed, ExxonMobil then requested the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality to issue a penalty to them so that the company could get the citizen lawsuit dismissed. According to the testimony of Barry Baisden, ExxonMobil's former manager of safety, security, health and environment at the Baytown complex, and the testimony of John Sadlier, former head of enforcement for the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality, ExxonMobil approached the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality after a lawsuit was filed and drafted its own order of penalty for the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality to issue. The order imposed a penalty of $98,000, half of which ExxonMobil was allowed to pay to the industry-run Houston Regional Monitoring Corp, of which ExxonMobil is a board member. Sprayberry found Environment Texas and joined the citizen lawsuit after years of suffering from respiratory illnesses. Growing up a couple of miles from the facility, Sprayberry was diagnosed with asthma when she was 3 months old, avoided outdoor play and trick-or-treating, slept with her back propped up, and learnt how to read the direction and timing of the wind to breathe. Even with all these precautions, she ended up in hospital with dyspnea, or shortness of breath, several times a year during her childhood, describing the experience as breathing through a tiny, tiny little straw. It wasn't until Sprayberry left Baytown at the age of 18 that she was given new lungs, as she put it. She proceeded to join the U.S. Navy, where they jumped out of helicopters, climbed walls, and endured strenuous physical activities she never thought possible before. When Sprayberry and her mother moved back to Baytown 36 years later for a job opportunity, she found that ExxonMobil plant had expanded exponentially. Her respiratory problems returned, her mother developed heart problems, and she then learned that colleagues in the school district where she was working were dying from cancer. The Environmental Protection Agency's standard for an acceptable level of cancer risk is 1 in 10,000. This means that out of 10,000 people living in an area, there would likely be one additional case of cancer due to exposure to toxic pollutants. ProPublica's map, based on the Environmental Protection Agency's data of cancer risk by pollutant emission, shows that residents around ExxonMobil's Baytown plant face a risk for cancer that is 2.8 times higher than the Environmental Protection Agency's acceptable threshold. Despite all the evidence, Oldham is advancing ExxonMobil's argument that the Baytown residents have no legal standing to bring the citizen lawsuit to federal court. To date, courts have applied what's known as the Cedar Point Powell-Dufferin test on legal standing for citizen lawsuits. According to these precedents, plaintiffs need to show that they have a concrete personal stake in the air quality of their neighbourhoods, that their injuries can be fairly traceable to a plant's violation of the Clean Air Act, and that the violations cause or contribute to the kind of injuries experienced by the plaintiffs. Oldham now wants citizen lawsuit plaintiffs to pass a but-for causation test. This means that plaintiffs would need to prove that their injury from a specific date could not have been caused by anything other than a specific violation of a specific date. Luke Metzger, Executive Director of Environment Texas, explains that such a requirement is an impossible standard when dealing with large, complex plants, which have different emission sources, as opposed to cases where there is only one source of pollutant discharge. Luke Metzger adds that emission events are not always visible to residents, and residents would not be able to tell which emissions are legal or illegal. Luke Metzger said, recognizing that the U.S. government sometimes does not aggressively enforce the law, Congress explicitly gave people a very important tool for reducing pollution themselves. He added, "These kinds of powerful tools protect our environment, hold companies accountable, and help prevent future violations. To not allow for full accountability of these violations, where you have to demonstrate a specific knowledge of a violation at a specific time, would be a dramatic departure from current rules around standing. It would have a chilling effect on the ability of citizens to hold polluters accountable if the government fails to do so." Before Donald Trump picked Oldham to be an appellate court judge from a list provided by the Federalist Society, Oldham had already made his mark as a deputy solicitor general and then the general counsel in Texas by attacking the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, which he called an illegitimate administrative state. During his time in Texas, the state filed at least 17 lawsuits challenging the Environmental Protection Agency's authority, two of which Oldham presented in front of the Supreme Court. In 2012, Oldham was already arguing that the EPA does not have the authority to regulate carbon emissions. In his brief for Utility Air Regulatory Group versus the Environmental Protection Agency, Oldham stated that greenhouse gases do not qualify as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act, and that the Chevron deference, a doctrine from a 1984 Supreme Court ruling that guides courts to defer to federal agencies with more expertise, is not explicitly stated in the Constitution.
This one lay. Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran has issued a warning about Israel's nuclear arsenal, in particular its nuclear warheads, which is estimated to number between 200 to 400. This is while Israel has not only been claiming that Iran is just a short time away from obtaining the bomb, it has also threatened Iran with military action. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how it is that Israel and not Iran, who is a threat not only to the Islamic Republic, but also to the West Asia region as a whole. But first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joins us from Marseille, France. Also joining us, former U.S. government advisor Paul LaRudy, who joins us from Berkeley. Welcome to you both. Paul LaRudy, I'm going to first start with you. I'm curious as to why Israel is pursuing a policy of what they call deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear weapons, when it is very well known that it does possess between 200 to 400 of them, warheads in particular. Not only the former U.S. President Jimmy Carter has said that, but you also have that whistleblower Vanunu who has claimed that. But why does it pursue this policy of what it calls nuclear ambiguity?
There's a very simple answer to that, and that is that the U.S. Congress has passed, the U.S. government has passed legislation saying that the U.S. cannot provide aid of any kind to any country that possesses nuclear weapons and develops nuclear weapons. Therefore, since this is an agreement between Israel and the United States, and the State Department of the United States every year certifies that they have no evidence that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, in which case it is permissible to provide Israel with aid. That's the bottom line. There are other reasons that Israel considers it advantageous, but this is the main one that began decades ago.
Like, what are the reasons that it does not want to claim that you said are advantageous for not stating it?
Well, they can't be held in non-compliance with various international treaties if they don't belong to those treaties, and if they supposedly don't have nuclear weapons, and they can't be held accountable, I think, on a variety of metrics, means of judging them. They can't be held accountable if it's not certain that they have these weapons.
Okay, Elijah Magnier, so we have what Iran has stated, and many are also questioning as to why you have the NPT, and when you have the threat that are posed by nuclear weapons, that Israel, which again, even though they don't want to admit it, but have 200 to 400 of these nuclear warheads, are not a member of the NPT. Iran says it should be a member of the NPT, the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. And the big question is, why isn't the IAEA actually fulfilling its responsibility in this regard to pursue this matter with Israel? Of course, Iran is saying that because it's also being threatened by Israel militarily, but above and beyond that, Israel keeps accusing Iran of pursuing a path towards weaponizing its nuclear program.
Thank you for having me. The answer is quite simple. The IAEA was formed in 1957 by the Americans. And since the 1957, the Israelis were engaged at the beginning with building a nuclear reactor with the help of France, Norway, and the Americans. And since then, the IAEA never inspected the Israeli nuclear plant. It was only later when Ben-Gurion admitted that the Dimona was hosting what used to be a textile factory, in fact, was a nuclear reactor. And the reason why the Israelis said for the first time, we're talking about in 1962, 1963, when they admitted the first time that they may have developed a nuclear weapons in their what used to be called textile factory, only deterrent to Arab actions against Israel. So since then, the Americans have created the Atom for Peace program at the time of President Eisenhower and camouflaged the Israeli reactor and the Israeli development of nuclear weapons. It was since then that the Americans planned to hide what the Israelis are doing to prevent the IAEA that were formed by the Americans to go and inspect what the Israelis have and to make sure that the public and the world is aware of the Israeli nuclear capability. Instead, they've hidden all that. The French has hidden all that. Norway hidden all that. And they all aware, the international community is aware, because they have, Norway provided 20 tons of water for the reactor, and France provided the reactor. So they all know what's happening in Israel. They all know about the weapon that Israel have. And also, we know that the Israelis were about to use nuclear weapon during the 6 days war with the Arabs. So now, failing to expose all that and to open the site to international community and international supervision, it shows us first that international supervision is not international, but is under the thumb of the Americans. Second, that everything the Israelis are doing is covered and supported by the Americans. Third, it's a cherry picking for the Americans to go and accuse Iran and Korea and China and the country that are not friendly to the US and push the IAEA to go and inspect what they are doing with the nuclear reactor, if it is for peace or for weapon purposes.
Well, one of the things that happens when you have a nuclear reactor is the fact that it poses a threat or a danger to the environment, Paula Rudy. And given the fact that it's not under the IAEA supervision, as we understand, that this in particular obviously provides a threat to the West Bank. You have nuclear waste that it is alleged that the Israel is burying in the West Bank. Shouldn't that be a matter of concern?
It's a matter of concern, especially to the Palestinians themselves. But this is, again, nothing new. Israel has used the occupied territories as a dumping ground for all sorts of toxic waste and materials. And so they consider this a way of continuing the genocide of the Palestinians, destroying the Palestinian people, at least those that are, well, in general, the Palestinian people, both those who are under their direct rule and those that are not, even outside. They've done similar things in Lebanon, for example, and Syria and so forth. They consider it an advantage to be able to put toxic materials where they want to make life miserable, difficult, and even to end life for the people that they want to get rid of. So this is just part of their policy of genocide.
You had an idea that came up during the former president, Iranian president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Elijah Magnier, and that was a West Asia or Middle East free zone, as he called it during that time. And just recently, again, Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN has drawn attention to this establishment of a zone free of WMDs, weapons of mass destruction, of which it was actually initiated by Iran at the UN. Israel is against that. It does not want that. Coming from Iran and the fact that Israel does not want that, what message is that sending?
Iran is sending a message that the Middle East, as the rest of the world, should be free of weapons of mass destruction. However, this is not what the Americans want. So if we look at all the American administrations, starting from Eisenhower to Kennedy to Johnson to Nixon, they all hide and hid all the Israeli capability for one purpose, is to keep a deterrence in the Middle East against the U.S. allies, against the U.S. enemies. So when Iran is coming out with a proposal saying we want the Middle East without weapons of mass destruction, is really targeting only Israel because it's the only place where there are weapons of mass destruction. And this is goes against the U.S. and the Israeli policy that want Israel to remain as the policeman of the region, which is not something that Iran accepts, and also all the countries where there is a population that stands against the normalization with Israel and refuse what the Israeli did by taking occupying the Palestinian territory. So by Iran saying, I want this, a Middle East or an area or half of the world or whatever, free of weapons of mass destruction, it goes against the U.S. and the Israeli policy that the U.S. will certainly refuse to abide by and would completely ignore the call for a weapons of mass destruction, which is obviously that is directed only toward Israel. And the Americans are not ready to compromise anything, what they call the security of the Israelis.
Paula Rudy, I think you also had a response to that.
Mr. Meunier is exactly correct. And the United States does not want to give up an advantage or the advantage of its ally, or Israel is just basically an extension of the United States, or you could say the United States is an extension of Israel, if you like. They have an advantage, which are the nuclear weapons, and they can always threaten others with them and cause problems, as we've already discussed. So they want to keep that advantage, and the idea of a nuclear-free or a nuclear weapons-free Middle East is they're not willing to consider it, and they don't have to. Because they're the power in the region.
But when you take a look at Israel, Elijah Magnier, Israel is the only entity right now that is not only attacking a sovereign nation repeatedly, namely Syria. It has actually attacked Syria's nuclear facilities at one point in order to, based on its views, to stop the further investment of its nuclear program. At the same time, it is threatening Iran militarily. So when you have an entity that is reacting that way and carries out operations like that, military operations, isn't then Israel at the highest risk of proliferation or using nuclear weapons?
Indeed, it is. Israel did not attack Syria's site only. It has attacked also Iraq in the 80s. To stop Iraq from developing its nuclear capability. So any country that stands as strong in competition with Israel, Israel reacts to it with the full support of the United States of America. Now, Israel represents a danger because the Israelis are really looking to attack any country that for them can create a threat to Israel. Now, the only threat in the region is Israel itself, to violate the Lebanese air space, to violate Syrian airspace, to bomb Lebanon, to bomb Syria, to bomb Iraq. They bombed many sites of the Hashd al-Shaabi and the Iraqi security forces, attacks in Iran and assassination. So it's Israel that is taking always initiative and is the first aggressor. Now, as long as it has what Israel called a deterrence, a nuclear deterrence, at the end of the day, I don't think this is a point of strength for Israel, because we've seen how Russia in Ukraine was not able to use its nuclear weapons. However, that doesn't justify that Israel needs to go unchecked and for the world to keep looking the other way about what the Israelis are doing and what are their nuclearity is in the Negev and the Dimona and what they are doing there and how they are developing and if that represents a danger to the civilian population.
Well, you have obviously one of the most important standoffs that can occur because of the way that Israel acts, and that is when it comes to Iran. We have seen what Israel has done in terms of acts of sabotage against Iran, from the assassinations of a number of nuclear scientists to facilities itself, which the most recent one was in Karaj. And one of the most recent developments also was how an Israeli spy cell was actually caught. And one of the revelations was that they wanted to lay bombs at a sensitive site in Esfahan, which according to one report they had already gone through and done that. So aren't these all signs that there needs to be some restriction, some oversight then, back to the question, through the relevant organization, which at this point is the IAEA, in order to stop anything from happening?
Well, neither the IAEA nor the United Nations nor any other organization is going to stop Israel from doing whatever it feels like doing as long as it feels that it has the power to do it without consequences to itself. And that's unfortunately the situation, and it's the situation of its sponsor, the United States as well. Both entities will do whatever they can to make others subservient to them and to enhance their control of various parts of the world, the population, the economy, the territory. We can talk about what the law says and what morality says and all of these things, but in the end, it is strength that talks. It is power that talks, and Israel is going to use whatever power it has in order to cause disaster for its neighbors, to keep its neighbors in check, and also to use its power to enhance, to enlarge its territory and increase its own power over its neighbors. And that's the same applies to the United States, which, as I said before, is just one is the extension of the other.
Well, Elijah Magner, Israel has sounded the alarm over Iran on so many occasions when it comes to its civilian nuclear program. A quick question that comes about during these times where we're looking at the revival of the JCPOA, if there's even a point of saying the revival if it's not dead yet, is why doesn't the U.S. just make the political decision to get back into the deal that the U.S. pulled out from in the first place in order to, in their eyes, eliminate any chances that there may be in their eyes again for Iran to pursue any type of weaponization of their program, which will then, by default, leave only Israel with nuclear weapons in West Asia?
Because when you give the Americans a finger, they won't. The problem is Iran is negotiating the Americans in good faith, but the Americans and the Europeans are in 2018. One is the American, Donald Trump, just threw away the JCPOA, and the Europeans find themselves withdrawing from Iran and not abiding by their signature. So you are dealing with Western organizations that just want to impose their will and dominate whoever country that is ready to be dominated. Iran is not on the list of dominated countries for the West, and by showing its rejection of the U.S. supremacy and the U.S. control and hegemony, Iran became the enemy. So whatever Iran is doing and offering, the Americans are trying to have a deal where they keep having the upper hand over the Iranians. And Iran is trying to say that we want a deal where we are both equal, where this is the big mistake Iran is doing, because the Americans are not interested in becoming an equal partner in this deal, because they are not a viable partner. They want the upper hand, and they want to make sure that they can return to the sanctions against Iran, because you are dealing with Western, not international organization like the IAEA, that brings out of the hat all the rabbits they want against Iran whenever they want, because they are pushed by the United States. And then you negotiate the peace, a deal that the JCPOA is saying, I agree to control my nuclear program that is weapon-free, and they say, no, but we want to impose sanctions on your institutions, because whenever we want, we can cripple your economy. So you are both talking different languages, and it is like you don't understand each other, because the American side is not ready to sit on the table as an equal partner. The Americans want the upper hand. That is the point.
Okay, we got about 30 seconds to give to you, Paula Rudy. You had a statement coming out from the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak that was interesting, that said Iran can transform itself into a nuclear power and it's too late to stop it by surgical attack. Of course, he goes on to say, again, talk about the timeline here, that it will take Iran 18 to 24 months in order to reach that, what did he call it, treating metal uranium and picking it. Well, he talked technically there. You know, you have the threat, and then, but it takes a couple of years, even though the threat is going to take a couple of weeks. Never understood how they always talk about weeks away, and we can go back to 20 years ago up to now. Anyways, what is interesting about this is the fact that you have Israel, who is very much against this JCPOA revival. Why would Israel really be against this if it feels threatened in any shape or form? By Iran pursuing, again, in its eyes, a nuclear weaponization program?
Well, the answer is that Israel does not feel threatened by it, and it considers that it can take whatever measures it needs in order to remain more powerful, especially in terms of nuclear weapons. It's not really afraid of Iran acquiring nuclear weapons, most of all because of the policies of the government. The government of Iran has said repeatedly that it has no interest in acquiring nuclear weapons and is not pursuing any nuclear weapons. So this, well. I think this is not an issue.
Thank you very much for that. Paul Rudy there, former U.S. government advisor. And thank you, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. Both of you, thank you for your input. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tapway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.